the spirit, hungry spirits, and these are animals. And this goes on forever and goes back forever. Actually, there's an end somewhere over there with relative to any one person, but it goes back this way forever. And your mind has been, you know, this is human realm. And your mind has been traveling like this, you know, through different, really, through different realms. And it's just projections, you know. But because it's projections, it's very easy to move between realms. So if you think of the most chaotic time in your life, you know, and how you move into chaotic depressions and stuff like that. I mean, imagine the mind going even deeper. I mean, like, the history of our mind so far in this life has been, you know, you feel better and then you feel worse, or you get really sick and you almost feel like an animal. I mean, the mind state almost goes to an animal. Like, if you were in a really bad war and fighting for your survival with bayonets face to face, you know, or if you were really, really depressed, or, you know, you had really bad cancer or something, and your mind state was just getting down to something super depressed and manic and chaotic, your mind would be getting close to this. And then according to Buddhism, it doesn't take much time. It doesn't take much for it to slip down under that line and become an animal state of mind. Where you see yourself as an animal and you think like an animal and your life is very, very crazy. It's like a super hallucinogenic thing where your whole existence is just fear and terror at everything that moves, you know, and that's how you spend your life. And then if a human gets a hold of you, it's like the worst thing that can happen. They either strip your skin off you and eat you, or they steal your fur or your coat, or they hook you up to some machine and make you do work, or they milk you, or they shave you, or, you know. Most animals end up being used by humans, because humans are smarter. They can outwit them and lock them up and use them and kill them for what they want. And then, so your mind, it doesn't take a lot for your mind to slip down. Apparently, according to all the scriptures, it can slip down really easy. And then this is just a chart of the state of your mind. You know, your mind, it's not restricted to these boundaries. You shouldn't think of it anymore that way. You know, your mind is not restricted to the boundaries of a human state. You know, it can slip down very easily. It doesn't take a lot. It just takes a few breaths. It takes a few exhalations and inhalations to become an animal. So, you know, don't think it's like impossible. It's just the mind slipping to another state, and it can go down really fast. And the purpose of the Lam Rim, if you think about the Lam Rim, it has three great divisions. They are called the person of lesser capacity, person of medium capacity, and person of great capacity. And those three are defined by their spiritual goals. Okay? And the people of lesser capacity, all they want to do is draw some kind of in computer programming, what do they call it, a firewall? They want to draw a firewall here. You know, firewall is what you do to your computer that hackers can't get into it. It's some kind of a, like a wall that you put between your computer and these crazy kids who like to blow up your computer by calling in and figuring out the passwords and stuff. And so they want to, I mean, kebu chung, which means people of lesser capacity, they want to create a wall here where their mind can no longer slip under that line. Okay, and if you chart the five paths, you know, this is pre-path. And this is when you start getting interested in Buddhism. And you can actually at this point already be practicing the three trainings. So you don't have to have reached the first Buddhist path to be practicing the three trainings. You can practice an ethical way of life. You can practice concentration. You can practice an elementary form of wisdom even before you reach the first path. Then how do you get to path number one, which is called accumulation? Yeah, it's when you truly get fed up with life. So you could say path of accumulation starts here and goes up to here. And that whole period there is called path of accumulation. It can take millions of years. So you're accumulating energy to reach the next path, which is what? So by the way, how you get from pre-path to first path, this is path number one, is you truly, truly get fed up with this mode of living, you know. And it doesn't mean like you have to be like a Saint Francis or something like that. I mean, you don't have to go into, you know, you can be quite easily disgusted with life and still be working in an office and still be eating and walking around New York City and, you know, I mean, the feeling of renunciation can be with you and will be with you as you walk through your life. And it's just that you don't want to be unhappy. It's very simple. It's when you get tired of being unhappy. And it'll start to happen wherever you are. It's not like there'll be a big change in your life and you'll run away to somewhere or something like that. You'll just get tired of being unhappy. You'll get tired of this up and down, up and down, up and down. And they'll get some kind of just tired of it, you know. I'm trying to find a pen that works. How about this one? I'm tired of these pens. Number two is called path of preparation. And during that path, it is marked by reaching certain levels of an intellectual understanding of emptiness. You're understanding emptiness intellectually. Number three is called path of seeing. This is the big time. This is when you see emptiness directly for the first time. A big milestone. Take a couple zillion years to get there. Path number three. Path number four. Habituation, getting used to what you saw, using what you saw to remove what? Your mental afflictions, okay? Using what you saw to start removing your mental afflictions. Path number five is called no more learning. No more learning. There's a point here. It's right about here. Into the path of preparation, where you achieve a cessation for taking a lower birth. You can never again go below this line, this human line, if you reach this point. Okay? If you reach a certain point in the path of preparation, which implies that you've reached a certain understanding about emptiness and a certain level of virtue, you can no longer ever go below this line. And that is the goal of what they call kibbutzimu, the lesser capacity. Okay. Sometimes they call it lesser scope. Sometimes they call it smaller person. There's all these different words for it. Kibbutzimu in Tibetan means smaller person. It means their scope is not as wide. All they want to do is definitely draw a line in the sand here and not go under here anymore. That's their whole practice is aimed at that. All they want to do is prevent that mind stream from slipping below this line. That's their goal. And we finished that. The teachings that we've had so far in the Lam Rim, like going for refuge and studying karma, sometimes goes either way, but are basically directed at keeping yourself out of these three lower realms. Okay? Those are Lam Kirimbas. Those are steps that are used by people of lesser capacity. Yeah.
Does that also mean you couldn't come back, say, as Hitler or something? No.
The only cessation is for going below this line.
Right. So you could be a lot less Hitler, because then you would create all that horrible
Well, he could do the four power thing, that's my idea. Unlikely, extremely unlikely. I think it's probably impossible by that point. You know, maybe theoretically, but I've never seen in a text that you achieve a cessation for being a bad person. You achieve a cessation for ever becoming an animal, preta, or hell birth. Yeah.
So if you become a deva, then you don't have that nasty thing that happens again?
Right. After this point, if you ever again become a deva, which is unlikely, you would never have that almost natural roller coaster down. Okay. You can't. You can't take birth below that line again. Which means that your mind can't slip below that line again. I prefer to think of it that way. It's very easy for me to imagine pure chaos. I mean, I have a bad day at work. That's medium chaos. You know, I've been in airplanes that were going to crash and stuff like that. I've had guns pointed at me, shot at. My mind was in, like, near chaos. You know, and I can imagine total chaos, like being in a car wreck and fire and stuff like that. You know, you can imagine it. But this is where your mind slips a little lower. And you enter a realm of complete chaos or pure chaos. And I think you can imagine it. It's a mental state. It's the mind dipping lower and lower. And you've had those moments of chaos in your life. You know, think of the worst one and then double it, and that's your mind going below this line. And it's not such a big deal. It's not so impossible. It's a mental state, and your mind can slip below that line. And you meet people who are not much different from animals, like in extraordinary circumstances. I've seen it, you know. They just turn into like an animal. And they look like an animal, they're probably thinking like an animal. And then for the mind to go below that line, it's not such a big deal. You have to believe that to be a gebuchumo, to be a person of small capacity, you have to really be worried about that. And it's extremely difficult to reach this path. It's very hard to get to path number one. It's a great spiritual achievement to be worried about your mind slipping below this line. Most people never get there. Most Buddhists never get there in this life. They never get to this first path. They never really believe that their mind could slip below here. They're not really worried about it. You know, in fact, you're not a Buddhist until you're worried about it. You're not practicing, strictly speaking, Buddhism until you're afraid and you're taking refuge. It's very interesting. If your reason for being a Buddhist is connected with some kind of this life going well, you're not a Buddhist. It's not Buddhist practice. It's like some kind of a better form of desire or something. It's very hard to be a Buddhist. It's very hard to reach this step where you really are worried that your mind might slip below this point. Go through the path of seeing. Now, you can cruise through here and you have all those sufferings that we talked about. We talked about the six sufferings in the last course. There are certain mental sufferings that you're always undergoing. We talked about, for example, that the human mind cannot be contented. In its present form, the human mind cannot be contented. You know, you get something, and then you want more. And you keep wanting more and more and more. Your mind cannot be contented. Your and my mind is of a nature that it cannot be contented. And there's five other sufferings like that. There's six sufferings, which are pretty much mental. And they're just, they force you to be unhappy. You know, they force us to be unhappy. You can decide, I'm not going to be discontented anymore, and then like 2 days later you're discontented again, you know. It's really funny, you know. You say, I'd like to get into a Buddhist class. You get in a Buddhist class, and then you're like, after a couple of classes, you're like, I wonder if they could like spice it up a little bit, you know. And then they say, okay, you're going to be the leader of the class. And you get interested again for a couple of weeks, and then you're thinking, well, I would rather be that. And your mind just goes on and wants more and more, and there's no end to it. You know, your mind will make you... I've heard people go up to Rinpoche and say, why do you teach this Lam Rim stuff, you know? Could you do something more interesting, you know? No, really. And I've thought it myself. You know, I said, yeah, gee, I wish he would teach some advanced logic or something. I've heard this before. You know, and you just get used to it, you know. And here he is, you know, the abbot of Saramay. He's the... In the year that he graduated, he was the highest monk in Tibet to graduate. And you want more, you know. It's like, well, maybe I could find someone even more interesting, you know. And your mind wants more and more. And that's That's our condition. So there's a point where you want to overcome those mental afflictions. And that happens around, it depends, normally here. Okay, that's called what? Nirvana. This is a point where you get no more lower births. We're going to talk about it. But nirvana implies no more coming back to the samsara. You will never be born in samsara again. So a person who reaches nirvana has gone like this and is out for the first time. You know, you can think of this whole area here as suffering. You know, and this whole area here is extreme suffering. And so you have to conceive of the Lam Rim as being three different states of mind. This, from here up to here, is the lesser capacity. You know, from there up to there is that's a person of lesser capacity. From entering Buddhism and starting to study up to the point on the path of preparation where you have no more lower births, you are what we call a person of lesser capacity. If that's your goal, if your goal is just to stop here, that's a person of lesser. That person at that point, all they understand is that they don't want to go under this line. That's their goal. After that point, a person figures out that even if they stay above that line, things are not happy. And the main suffering is your own mind makes you unhappy. Your own mind drives you to be discontented. You cannot be happy. We don't have the capacity to be contented. Just can't do it. You can go sit on the beach and watch the sunset, and after 2 hours you want to go to do something else. You can't be satisfied. It just doesn't work. You can go have an excellent ultimate dinner, and then it's not an ultimate dinner because you want another one. You know, and you go try to go back to the same restaurant, and the same thing doesn't happen because you meet a different waiter, and they yell at you, and you know, this person here who reaches here has decided that they want to get out of it altogether, and that would be nirvana. Okay, so they work really hard and they get out of it. So you can call up here, you know, like nirvana, and that from here to here, you're working on the motivation of a medium motivation. This person wants to reach happiness. This person wants to reach contentment. This person wants to overcome their mental afflictions and not live this kind of existence anymore. What happens beyond that? If you reach nirvana under the influence of bodhicitta, which is the wish to help other beings, it turns into enlightenment. Okay? In fact, in the text, Tsongkhapa talks about it as a Sergyur Gitsi. Say Sergyur Gitsi. Sergyur Gitsi means, there's a thing in alchemy, you take a piece of steel, iron, and you put certain things on it. In Tibet they believed it was related with quicksilver, with mercury. Something to do with mercury, and there's all these other things. There's like 12 different substances, and you mix them together. Nagarjuna was good at it. He got kicked out of Nalanda for doing it, because it's not a proper monk way to make a living. He was trying to raise money for the monastery. And you do this special thing, and the iron turns into gold. And they say that bodhicitta is like that, like the wish to, that wish that all other beings should reach happiness and stop suffering. I mean, and again, I the way it helps me to imagine it is, I mean, I've been in Hong Kong and I think about New York and Hong Kong usually when I think about suffering, mental suffering, and then think of, you know, in Hong Kong it's maybe 6 to 8 million people, and then when I think of New York it's about 8 million people. And I imagine 8 million mind streams driven by 8 million inabilities to be contented. You know, 8 million separate instances of discontentment driving 8 million people to wear out their bodies on things that are worthless, you know. And it's called human commerce, you know. It's called the economy, you know. And 8 million minds driving 8 million poor, tired bodies, that, you know, to run around the city and try to make a buck, you know, or try to do something that is gonna. It's without question, it must be lost. You know, if you think for 5 minutes without any kind of doubt, whatever they're working for, they must lose it. And there's no question about it. There's no debate about it. There's no other career path for them except to wear out the body. The mind is hyperactive, and it wears out the body, and the body dies, and then the body loses all the things that the mind wanted. And that's human life. And if you just think about it for a while, that's bodhicitta. Bodhicitta is like thinking, you know, 8 million poor bodies being driven by 8 million unsatisfied minds into the ground. You know, it's just sad. There's no future for anybody. There's no future for all 8 million people except to have their body wear out. And then they're in a hospital somewhere, and that's it. And that's just the only future. So if you think about it that way, that kind of thought is called the alchemical elixir in Jetsun Kapa's text. You know, you can do good deeds. You can provide people with homes. You know, like we do for the monks in India, 900 monks. We're feeding them, we're clothing them, we're making sure they have a place to stay. But if you don't do it with in the back of your mind with the idea that you would like to see these people reach enlightenment, you know, that you would like to see them get out of this suffering. Monks in the monastery suffer as much as anybody. I mean, it's 1,000 minds running 1,000 bodies around the monastery. Maybe many of them just in a worldly way, you know, and their bodies are being run into the ground also. If you feed them and clothe them, if that's all you think about, it's like iron. The only karma that can come out of that is that you yourself will have certain material things in the future. And they will wear out. The karma will wear out, the things will wear out, and the whole thing was a wasted exercise. You know. But if you do it with the intention that I want to provide things for them so that I reach my own paradise, my own enlightenment, and then knowing how to do it, I will turn around and help everyone else do it. That has to be in the back of your mind. That turns the action into goal. It's bodhicitta. How does that work as you understand projection right now? What's the way it works? How does it work? I mean, what's the difference between the future projections of a person who feeds and clothes a lot of monks and doesn't think about enlightenment, and then a person who feeds and clothes a lot of monks and does wish that they get enlightened, or wishes that he gets enlightened, or she, so they can achieve. What's the difference? What's happening?
The motivation.
The motivation is different, but how does that change the result? I mean, one person gets a house, a big house, and nice clothes in samsara, in the future, and they wear out, and they end up with a net zero. And the other person is doing it so they get enlightened, and then they are starting to have, if they did it with a real strong motivation, tantric experiences in this life. They are starting to, I mean, getting to Buddhist paradise, which means your projection's shifting, it doesn't happen all at once. I mean, you start getting experiences. You know, they start to accumulate. And so what's the difference between these two people? What's the difference? The result is quite different. You know, one person's getting something which wears out and they end up back where they were. And the other person is getting...
They're getting further along that line.
Is getting to Buddhist paradise. But what's... Is it... What's the difference?
The perception.
It's the perception that's going on while they're doing it. For some reason, okay, focusing on others' needs as you do a good deed and dedicating it to the ultimate benefit of them completely transforms the karma. So that's what the text means. You know, you think about doing any good deed as steel. And if you do the good deed with a certain motivation, like I would like this to help me become enlightened. I want this to help me reach my own Buddha paradise so that I can show people how to get there. If that's your motivation, for some reason it totally changes the experience. You think about it. I'm just throwing it out to you. It's a homework question, okay? What is it about being concerned for others that changes an activity from what we call a simple good deed to what we call a perfection, a paramita? You know, what's the difference? You know, what is it in the emptiness and the karma of it that's different? You know, you think about it. You have to think about it. It has something to do with focusing on the other people while it happens.
And
yeah, bodhicitta is being driven by a concern for their ultimate welfare. Like, as you give someone clothes and food, you're thinking, okay, I'm paying for this guy's room, but I'm not just doing it to pay for the guy's room. I want this guy to reach a Buddhist paradise for myself out of this, so that I can take this person there, or something like that. You have to think about that is the dependent origination of the event. It's very interesting. You know, it's going to lead to a certain projection in the future. You're going to collect a karma in your mind, a karmic seed, and it's going to flower in the future and make you see yourself as an enlightened being. As opposed to see yourself as a person who just got a big house and a big car. The action is the same. You're giving something to somebody. But there's something about it that transforms the steel into gold. So you have to think about it. Okay? Yeah.
And have this question.
Exactly. That's part of the key, but we won't go into it much. She's talking about the, as you do a good deed, seeing the emptiness of the giver, the gift, and the giving itself, and like that. It seems to be something about the perception while you're doing it that you are concerned for their ultimate benefit. Having that thought in your mind changes the karmic collection. It changes the planting of the seed into a planting of a seed for ultimate nirvana, ultimate enlightenment, rather than planting a seed for a temporary result like a big car and a big house and like that. So that's the key to that verse. In that verse, he's saying this motivation can change a normal good deed into a cause for your own paradise. But think about it.
Wouldn't that person have to be touched by emptiness first, where the other person didn't
have it? We're going to talk about it at the end of the class tonight. Okay. But I think about it in terms of the highest school's explanation of dependent origination, which is what? Things are dependently originating because... That's the lowest school's. If you say because they are caused, that's the lowest school's presentation. Because they are your projections, forced on you by your past karma. That's the meaning of dependent origination. So if on your homework it says, connect dependent origination and Jetsun Kapa's statement that bodhicitta turns a deed from steel into gold, you know, you have to work on it. It's a koan, okay? Fran Perillo will like this one. Banza. Think about it. I think it's better not to give you any answers. You have to think about it. But just remember that the Prasangika presentation of what dependent origination means is that, why did I get into this? Dependent on your projections. Okay. And somehow that's got something to do with bodhicitta turning in a good deed from steel into gold. Okay, think about that. Why did I get into this? Oh. Okay, we talked about taking refuge, and taking refuge is the main lam rim that prevents you from going below this line. Now, we've reached the medium person's capacity. What do they want to do?
They want cessation of that one.
They want to get out of all these lines. They don't want to be at any strata. They don't want to be at any bandwidth. They want to be out of the music. Okay? They want to get out completely to a place called nirvana. Because they perceive that no matter where you are, no matter where your mind goes up and down here, it's all suffering. Okay? And to do that, the classic instruction for the medium capacity person is called Pakpe Denpa Shi. Say Pakpe Denpa Shi. Pakpe Denpa Shi. Pakpa is what? Arya. Okay, and Arya. What's an Arya? Master race? Yeah, okay. It means anyone who's perceived emptiness directly is an Arya. So Pakpa, which was mistranslated, like everything else practically, by the early Buddhist scholars, who, you know, were pioneers and did a great job, but we're lucky that the Chinese pushed the Tibetans out and we got better teaching, was, how did they translate Pakpe Denpa Shi? Denpa means truth, Shi means four. They said what? They said four noble truths, and we're stuck with this. Arya doesn't mean noble, it means Arya, meaning someone who's seen emptiness directly, because you perceive these four truths directly in the aftermath of seeing emptiness directly. On the day that you see emptiness directly, after you come out of that experience, which takes like 15 to 20 minutes, for the rest of the day you have all these spiritual realizations. They can be grouped into four groups called the four Arya truths, because they can only be perceived by people who have just become Aryas, okay? And they're nothing to do with noble, okay? And I'm going to talk to you, we're going to go over the Four Noble Truths, which is the method for people of medium capacity to do what they want to do, which is what? They just want to get out of those six births. They want to reach nirvana, okay? Reaching nirvana and getting out of the six births is the same thing or not? Is reaching nirvana and getting out of those six lousy births the same thing?
No.
What's the definition of nirvana?
Through
the realizations that follow seeing emptiness directly. There is ultimate nirvana, and that's Buddhahood, but forget that one. Yeah. You had a question? So is getting out of the six realms and nirvana the same thing? Because, I mean, it gets blurred, right? I mean, arhats are getting into nirvana. Nirvana is no more suffering. They're out of the six realms. Yeah, there's two flavors of nirvana. One is called Phakche, say Phakche. One is called Phagme. Phakche means you're still stuck with an old body. Okay, you're still encased in this doomed flesh. Okay, I mean you've reached nirvana, which means you've finished off your mental afflictions forever, but you're still stuck in this body. That's called Phakche. That's called nirvana with a remainder, with something left over. And then when that body dies off, when that body wears out, you reach nirvana, which is Phagme, and you don't. And that means you no longer have any impure body left. And then you take on a different body. Okay. Yeah.
People with medium capacity.
Yeah.
They see emptiness directly. This sort of reminds me of Hinayana.
Yeah. It is Hinayana.
Okay.
This is a Hinayana motivation.
Yeah. Is it possible that this Hinayana person with medium capacity see emptiness directly and have this bodhicitta experience?
It's possible. There's a whole huge subject in the Prajnaparamita about that, and it's a huge flow chart called Genden Nishu, the 20 permutations. Okay, but basically, a person who's on a lower track, there's three tracks, right, of five paths each, and these two are Hinayana number one and Hinayana number two, okay? And you can start out here and then go to here, and then go to here, you know? You can get to here and then degenerate, you know, stuff like that. There's a lot of movement between those. You can even get to here on this track and then you have to start it back here again. Okay? Yeah, all those are possible. And it's quite possible for a Hinayana person to see emptiness. Now, up until the lower half of the Madhyamika school, they believe that they perceive a different emptiness than they perceive on the Bodhisattva track. But the higher school says that's not true, because emptiness is emptiness. It's either emptiness or it's not emptiness. It's not like there's three flavors of emptiness, you know. It's either pure emptiness or not. And they say these people can see emptiness directly. And they can reach nirvana, a lower nirvana, in which they personally don't have any more bad thoughts, and they have gotten out of suffering. And that's what a lower, that's what a medium capacity person is working for, one of these two lower nirvanas. And that's all they're working for. Yeah?
So before you said that if you get between path 2 and path 3, like between preparation and seeing, you achieve a cessation to achieve a lower birth.
Right.
And you just pointed your arrow down at the lower birth at that very point.
Oh, I know. That was a lower track of the five paths.
Yeah.
There's three tracks. Two of them are Hinayana, and one is Bodhisattva. And you can get all the way to the end of track of Hinayana track and reach Hinayana Nirvana. And then you might have to go back up to here on the Bodhisattva track to start over again. That's why they say don't waste your time. You might as well start here. You got to come back here anyway. And there's a huge debate about whether these two tracks end there or whether ultimately they both come back up here. And the answer is, yeah, ultimately you have to come back and start up here. So you might as well start here from the beginning.
The track is the lesser, the
beginning, the good. You can roughly say that. I'm not going to get into it tonight because we got places to go. Okay. Four Arya truths, which is the teaching by which medium capacity people get their rear ends out of samsara. Say dumyel. Demba. Dumya Demba. Now you can teach the Four Noble Truths in two different ways. And this is from the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. You can teach them in the way that they happen in reality. So if I tell you that the four Arya truths are suffering, where suffering comes from, end of suffering, and how you get to the end of suffering, I mean, which of those comes first, logically? In the way things really happen. The cause of suffering. I mean, first something causes it. If you're going to teach the four Arya truths in the order in which they actually occur, you'd have to teach the truth of the source of suffering first, the cause of suffering first. Then you would teach suffering. And then you would teach the path. And then you would teach cessation. If you were going to do it, what we call Gyundegi Rinpa, which means cause and effect order. But that ain't the way it's normally taught. I mean, there's two different ways. It is taught both ways. This is the order in which a normal person figures it out. It's called Lumbar Tope Rinpa, which means the order in which a person figures it out. Because first they bump into suffering. And then they start to wonder, where did that come from? Okay. And this is called the order in which a person understands them, you know, ultimately. Okay? So the first one is Dumyel Demba. The first noble truth, Arya truth, that you ever bump into is suffering. Okay? There's two flavors of this suffering. Okay? I'm giving you four pairs of divisions, just because it looks nice. You can do it a lot of different ways. But on your homework, it's like 2-2-2-2, okay? This is, first one is called Madakbe Nirki Jikten. Madakbe Nirki Jikten. Madakba means impure. N is a difficult word to translate. It means any kind of vessel, like a frying pan, a vase, a cup, a pot, a kettle. Those are all nus. Okay, so I'll say vessel of the world. The place in which the second half is all contained. Okay, who's the contents? What are the contents? Say madakbe.
Madakbe.
Chu.
Chu.
Ki semchen. Chu means contents. Semchen means living beings. Okay, those six kinds of beings. Okay, beings, living beings. By the way, when we say living beings, it's a code word in Buddhism. It does not refer to enlightened beings. Okay, they are living, yes, but when I say living beings, I mean suffering living beings. Okay. So you can divide Dunyo Denpa into two things: the world in which you live, and the living beings who live there, all the living beings who live there. Those are both the truth of suffering. It's very interesting. I don't like the name truth, and there's a huge debate about it in scripture. And I ask you, is this eraser the truth of suffering? It is the truth of suffering. See, truth in this context means fact. Okay? It does not mean, oh, this is true or false. It doesn't have to do with that. It means fact. If I were going to re-translate Buddhism and start it all over again in English, I would have said the four Arya facts or something. Okay, this is Dunyo Denpa. This eraser is Dunyo Denpa. Okay?
It's not the idea.
Excuse me?
Not the idea.
It's part of the world in which those suffering beings inhabit, and it is the truth of suffering. This is the truth of suffering. This eraser is the truth of suffering.
Go away.
Huh? That would be nirvana, I know. Okay? It's very interesting. Every object in your world is the truth of suffering. Except, you know, some spiritual realizations you have or anything like that. Your eyeball is the truth of suffering. Your ear is the truth of suffering. Your watch is the truth of suffering. Your car is the truth of suffering. Your job is the truth of suffering. I didn't have to say that, right? Everything is the truth of suffering. Everything around you is the truth of suffering. We'll see why later. I mean, basically, it's going to make you suffer. You know, this thing will wear out. If you like it, you will lose it. Okay? You cannot relate to this object without losing it. Period. And that's suffering. Okay? If it's useful to you, and if it performs a function for you, and if it makes your life a little easier, it's the truth of suffering because you must lose it. You will be, someday me and this eraser will be separate. Okay? It's indubitable. It's undebatable. It's incontestable. I will have to lose this eraser. I will have to lose all of you. You know, I'll have to lose this place. You know, we must disperse on some occasion. There will be the last class with us. And that's the truth of the suffering. You must lose your body. Your body, this arm, I must lose this arm. It must happen. I mean, normally speaking. Not if we do some special things. Okay. Anyway, impure vessel of the world and impure contents, living being. And we'll see why later. I mean, there's an innate defect which makes me lose everything. There's something wrong. There's some kind of corrupt energy behind all these objects which makes me lose them. And there's some kind of corrupt energy even behind my own mind which prevents me from ever being contented in this life. Okay? There's some energy driving my mind and my world and my body which is defective, and I must lose them, and they must make me unhappy. Okay? That's the nature of it. So that's Dunyo Denpa. It's everything around you. Sakche Lamge, Abhidhamma Kosha, opening line. Chundam Sakche Sapame, Lama Tobi Duche No. Oh, good it seems to start out. You may have noticed. Something will happen. And it's not their fault, it's not your fault. There's a defective energy running the thing. It could never have been perfect. Don't feel guilty, okay? It's not your fault, it's samsara. It's the energy that's running the show. Even if it goes smoothly between you and somebody else, you'll get ripped apart by some events. Have to, will. And that's Dunyo Denpa. Okay. Next one is what? In the order in which you figure them out. Yeah, what caused it? Say Kunjung Denpa. Kunjung Denpa. Okay, two flavors here. Kun means everything. Jun means came from. Kunjung is a word in Tibetan that means where everything came from. The source of suffering. Denpa means that truth or that fact. Say le. Le means what? Karma. Okay. The first troublemaker. And then our old friend and intimate acquaintance. Say Nyomo. Nyomo. Mental affliction. Jealousy, hatred, desire, anger. And 84,000 assorted flavors. Okay. Leda Nyomo. Is this pen Kunjung Denpa? Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty good answer. It's not really mental. I mean, lay is an action, right, of body, speech, or mind. Karma is an action of body, speech, or mind. It's a thought or a word that you say to somebody or some kind of thing you do with your body. Nyomong is just a bad thought. But this Nyomong is a little tricky. When it's part of Kunjung Denpa, it's Nyomong Ba. Okay, we have to change it. We have to fix it. We have to add a Ba. Nyomong Ba. That changes it completely. Those of you who are aspiring to be translators, be aware of this distinction. It's a huge difference between a Nyomong and a Nyomong Ba. Nyomong is a mental affliction. Nyomong Ba means a mentally afflicted thing. Now, Kanchi Deda La Sanam Kundu Gyeborgyur Abhidhamma Kosha, because you get mental afflictions towards this subject. Then there's this huge debate, well, is an arhat Nyomong Ba? Because isn't it possible for somebody to get mad at an arhat? No. I mean, it gets very tricky. Okay, we won't go into it. But in the monastery, when you debate it, if you debate it for a long time, you come out with this thing where anything that's Arya Truth number one is also Arya Truth number two. Anything that is suffering is also causing suffering. And you got to think about it. It's difficult. It's a huge debate. But in the bottom line is that. Yeah. One is the contents, that the world that holds the beings, and the other is the beings who are held in that world, or who inhabit that world. Yeah. Okay. So those are the two parts of Kunjung Denpa. So Kunjung Denpa is all around you also. Everything in your life is Kunjung Denpa. Except for the few good moments in your meditations or something, or if you're able to do Tonglen while you're walking down the street. But I'd say for me, from 9 to 5:30, you know, I don't think there's a single event of that's not the first and noble truth, except unless I hold my anger at work, or, you know, unless I have some opportunity to practice Dharma at work. If my mind is on the business, it's all samsara. It's all suffering. Everything is suffering. The thought, the object, the activity, everything is suffering. And it's causing more suffering. Maybe I shouldn't do that. Anyway, gotta eat, right? By the way, there's no reading for tonight because we couldn't finish it. Because it was too hard. It was too long. And we'll try to give it out at the review, which will be on Monday. Okay. Say Gokden.
Gokden.
Gokden. Gok means cessation. I'll give you all the... Gok means choke. That's got. Gok means constipation. Gok means, you know, stuck at the border. The guards won't let you through. You know, gok is all these meanings of obstruction and stopped up and stopped. You know, and that's what gok. So cessation is like, I don't like the word so much because I don't think it's ever used in normal English. You know, you don't say, I have a cessation of my boss. He finally left, you know. You know, or I have a cessation of income because I got unemployed, you know, or something like that. You know, you don't... But anyway, I think we're stuck with it. Den means truth, which means fact. You remember what gokcha is? Oh, by the way, how do you translate that? The end of suffering. Okay, the end of suffering. I mean, the first thing you think... First you think about suffering, then you think, where did this come from? And then you think, how could I stop it? I'm sorry, I'd like to stop it. Okay. Which implies cutting off number two, which is what? The cause of suffering. Okay, so number three is related to number two because number three is cutting off number two.
Okay.
Yeah, gakcha, say gakcha.
Gakcha.
Gakcha, it sounds like gakcha, right? Gakcha is the thing that we deny. Okay? It's the thing that we deny. It's the thing we would like to prove doesn't exist. Okay. Now there's two very, very different flavors of gaccha, and they are they're going to be here. They're going to be Gokten Part 1 and Gokten Part 2. What do you want to call gaccha? Because I don't. Translators fight with each other about this one. Well, let's say gaccha. How's that? There's two gacchas, and they're very, very different, and most people never figure it out. Okay. There's the gaccha which is stopped by the path. For example, is believing that things are self-existent something you would like to stop?
No.
Excuse me? Yeah, no. I'll say it again. Is believing that things are self-existent something you would like to stop?
Yes.
Of course.
But
does believing that things are self-existent itself exist? Of course, it's the source of all suffering. It's dependent origination link number one. Go down and look at the painting. It's a blind guy. Believing that things are self-existent. So of course it's something we would like to stop. It's the source of all evil. And that's not money, but it's related maybe. Okay, so the gaccha stopped by the path, a good example of that kind of gaccha would be believing that things are self-existent. And that gaccha exists. Okay, that gaccha really does exist. That belief in self-existence, it exists, and it causes all our trouble. When you stop it, now I'll put here, is stopped. That is Gokden. That is the third noble truth. Okay? When you stop the belief that things are self-existent, you have reached Gokden. Yeah?
You're calling the belief in a self-existent thing a self-existent.
Not yet. Not yet. Okay? And we'll get into it. We're going to get into it. You know what gaccha is from California. I'm expanding on your knowledge of gaccha. Okay? I'm introducing you to another gaccha. There's actually two gacchas. I never told you about the second one. Okay. Gaccha stopped by the path is stopped, which means you are able to stop the intellectual belief in self-existence. You never again believe that it's the right thing to think that it's self-existent. What path stops that? Yeah, path of seeing right here. Okay. The first time you see emptiness directly at the path of seeing and you come out of it, when you come out of that experience, you start again to see things as self-existent. But you know you're wrong. Okay. So the intellectual belief in self-existence has been stopped forever. You will never again believe yourself when you think things are self-existent, even though you can't stop yourself from thinking things are self-existent. Okay. But at least you know you're wrong. Okay. At that point, you have reached Gokten for the intellectual belief in self-existence. So that's an example of the truth of cessation. That's one example of the truth of cessation. Now I'll give you another one. If there was a two-headed pink elephant, full-sized two-headed pink elephant in this room, and I'm not counting Leon's part, okay? Would he or she be behind this blackboard or in front of this blackboard? I mean, are those the two choices? Either behind the blackboard or in front of the blackboard? If there was, I'm saying, if there was a two-headed full-sized pink elephant in this room, not counting Leon's area, would he or she either have to be behind the blackboard or in front of the blackboard? Well, or on, okay, but kind of, I'm saying full size probably couldn't sit on it, okay. But I mean, it's reasonable to say that they're either in front of this line or behind this line. And if you look in front of this line and they're not there, and then you look behind the line and they're not there, you can safely say there's no two-headed pink full-sized elephants in this room. That is Madhyamika reasoning. Madhyamika reasoning works the same way, exactly the same way. Madhyamika reasoning defines an area, splits it into two or three places, area, you know, sub-areas, and says, let's go look for what?
A so-called
food. Just the important part. Demons hate this part. I'm going to go look for a so-called self-existent thing.
In the front of the blackboard and behind the blackboard. Those are the two choices. Let's see. Any self-existent things in front of the blackboard? By the way, they don't exist, right? Anyway, they are exactly like a pink, two-headed, full-size elephant. So I look around. No self-existent things here. None behind here. I guess it doesn't exist. That's exactly how Madhyamika reasoning works. Madhyamika reasoning is seeking to prove the non-existence of something that never could have existed and never did exist and never will exist by looking for it in all the places it could have been if it did exist. I mean, you got to think of it that way. Okay? And this gakcha is one of those, quote, so-called self-existent things which never existed anyway. That's this gakcha, gakcha number two. Okay? Can you stop that gakcha? No, how can you stop something that was never there anyway? I mean, can you kill a pink elephant with two heads full-sized in Leon's classroom, you know? You can't. I mean, that's why you have to say stopped in quotation marks here. And then middle path reasoning proves that that thing that never was isn't there. Okay? But you are grasping to that thing at in every instant of your existence. You are grasping to that thing.
Yeah, but did you ever see pink elephant?
Oh, the imagination of a pink elephant exists.
Yeah, but did you ever see a pink elephant?
No.
So how can you be sure that it's not here or on the other side of the room?
Full size, meaning 6 feet
yeah,
tall.
Full size.
Because I can imagine what it would look like if it did exist. And you can imagine what the self would be like if it did exist. And that's you see, the imagination exists. That's the gakcha here. The imagination of a self does exist. To believe in it does exist. But the thing you believe in doesn't exist. And never did and never will. Okay? But somehow believing in it causes you trouble. These are both called gokden. Very interesting. Number two is equivalent to what? When you stop it, and I'll state it differently. When you establish the non-existence of a self-existent thing, you have established emptiness itself. Number two is exactly the same as the absence of a self-existent thing is called emptiness. That's shunyata. So, gokden number two, truth of cessation number two, is emptiness itself. It's the fact that that thing that was never there ain't there. Emptiness itself is the second part of gokden. That's very subtle. Okay. And when you reach gokden, a certain part of you is gokden, which is called by another word, when you're enlightened, it's called what? Dhammakaya. That's kind of cool. Okay. Okay, number four, and then we'll take a break. It's getting a little heavy, right? This is the easy part. Truth of the love, which is path. Truth of the path, number four. It's a very natural progression. You become aware of suffering. Your first reaction is, you know, nobody asks, where did this raise come from? But the minute they don't give you a raise, you're like, why? You know? I'm very familiar with this. So, you have suffering, and the natural reaction to suffering is to ask yourself, why me? You know, why me? And then you want to stop it, and then you figure out how to stop it. And that's the truth of that. You can divide it into two. For convenience sake, It really consists of five different paths. Have you ever seen them written down somewhere? The five paths? Sound familiar? Oh, right there. Okay. Right here, these five paths, okay? If you want to divide them into two, you could put number one and number two together, and you could put three through five together on the basis of what? Has this dude or dudess seen emptiness directly or not. Okay? If they have not yet, on a single track, because there's possible weird things, but if they're on bodhisattva track and they haven't seen emptiness yet, you could group them into paths 1 and 2. And then all the people up here who have seen emptiness directly, you could group them into 3, 4, 5. Okay. So the first part of the path, the truth of the path, consists of the first two paths, accumulation and preparation. The second part consists of the last three paths. In reality, if all you want to do is get out of suffering, if all you want to do is get out of this kind of unhappy life, you have to go through these four truths. You have to understand them. Okay? You have to go through this process up here. The first thing to do is to recognize what suffering is. It's extremely difficult. You know, we are suffering, and everything in our world is suffering. So it's very hard to recognize it. It's very weird. You know, but basically, just think of your own unhappiness. You know, in fact, if you're your own unhappiness, okay, your lack of bliss, okay, and that's really all it takes. And then you go through understanding emptiness, then you see emptiness directly, and then you use that knowledge in your day-to-day life to wipe out your mental afflictions. That's it. That's the Four Noble Truths. Okay. And if you study those well, and if you master them, you will reach nirvana. Nirvana being like a golden porthole out there in space. Sometimes I think that's the meaning of a halo. And once your mind reaches that place, you can never again be unhappy. You cannot be jealous. You cannot have desire. You cannot be irritated. You cannot be stressed. You can't have anxiety, you can't have low self-esteem, you can't have any of those things are out of the question for you. You cannot even have those thoughts. And your mind can never be budged out of that light. Your mind is in that light and nothing, no external event can budge it out. When I say external event, is it still possible for that person who has reached that golden light state in their mind to have a lousy day? Absolutely, and you will. Okay, they're not unhappy, and they are not disturbed by the lousy day. Their mind is totally free of any kind of irritation or sadness or upset or not capable of being budged out of that state of happiness. But they can still get hit by a car. They can still have the boss yell at them. They can still, you know, not have enough money, you know, stuff like that. Totally possible for a while. But if you stay in that place for a reasonable amount of time, those other things wear out and they don't come back. They never come back. You're out. And it will, before you die, you're out. I mean, that's the limit. Your body. Then your body goes into a different body. Okay. Take a break, 5-10 minutes, and we'll cover Mahayana in 10 minutes. Freedom from fear. I mean, helping people out of depression, anxiety, helping people getting mugged, helping countries who are getting eaten up by other countries, stuff like that. Teaching people how to get out of their suffering. Best kind of giving. I meet some people who say, I'm just going to do number 3 so I don't have to do the other 2, and it's very suspicious. So I think normally bodhisattvas are doing all 3. If you took secret vows, you're actually supposed to do a 4th one, which I'm sure you know about. So I don't have to go over it. That's the perfection of giving. I don't have to do the morality one because you learned about it in the first part of this course. All I have to add is that it includes bodhisattva morality and tantric morality, if you have those vows. What's perfection number 3? By the way, are they perfections? Nobody who went to California can answer. No, they're not. You're not perfect at giving. You're not perfect. We can practice the perfections, by the way, but they're not perfections for us, right? So technically, the real perfections are had by an enlightened being. Okay? We have what is called making perfections. Making perfections. Okay? And what we do is those. So they're called perfections, but they're not really perfections. They are trying to become perfect. They're called paro tu chin che instead of paro tu chin sin. Making you perfect instead of being perfect. Did you have a question?
Yeah, it is in fact possible perfection.
Yeah, a Buddha has perfected all six. In the mental stream of a Buddha, those six are true perfections. We call them paro tu chin sin, which means gone to the other shore, gone. And then in our, they're paro tu chin che, which means getting us to the other shore. And so there's a big argument about the scriptures, and they finally come up with that. Technically, for it to be paro tu chin che, it has to be done with a pretty good understanding of emptiness, but if you're really doing it for the benefit of others and to reach Buddhahood, even just in a very rough conceptual way, it's already a perfection. So the bottom line is that you and me can practice perfections if we have even a little idea as we do it that I'm doing this so that I can become a Buddha so I can help other people. Okay? Alright. Perfection number three is what? Yeah, I like to call it not getting angry. They call patience, I don't know, for me patience doesn't quite do it. Patience means not getting antsy in the dentist's office, I don't know what. But anyway, it means not getting angry. It can also be at inanimate objects. Like if you stub your toe and you curse, you've broken the perfection of sabba. Not getting angry. It's not getting angry about anything. And I'm not going to go into much more detail about it. Our dream is that in 1997, this class will have four courses on the Bodhicaryavatara, on the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which is extraordinary. And we are going to use the best commentary ever written, never been translated, by Jetsun Kapa's main student, Gyaltsebje, who's on the left up there, under his right knee. So we'll cover it then. If we're still here. Next perfection, what?
Joyful
effort. All I have to say about that is have a good time with your Dharma. You know, there's a certain point in your practice that you can reach where it's just fun. And that's the whole idea. It's where you're really having a good time doing your Dharma practice. And you get to a certain point, and we can help each other do that. You know, I think there's been times when we really got into it, and I think it'd be really cool if we try to stay in that. You know, I know in California, I just felt this joy the whole time, and we were all just, we knew we were being really good, and it felt really good, and we were really happy being good. So I think it's just being happy about Dharma, you know, instead of resisting it or something. Just throw yourself into it, have a good time being good. And that's the definition. Tsungkhang Gela Draw All. That's the chapter from Shantideva. What is the fourth perfection? It is to have a good time doing virtue. Okay. That's number four. I want to talk a little bit about number five and six, and then we'll stop. We didn't touch Jetsun Kapa's. I mean, you know, we didn't scratch it. Maybe we have to do it again. I don't know. But that's. I just wanted you to get the Lamrim feeling a couple of times every year. Okay. I'd like to talk about the advanced forms of the last two perfections. Okay. What's the fifth perfection?
Concentration
or meditation. The ultimate form of it is called. People put an H here and call it shamatha because the Sanskrit is aspirated. It doesn't make any sense in English. It's not tha. It's ta. English is fine. T, it's a real English T. No reason to put an H there. Some people leave out the H here because there used to be a diacritic there and they left it out when someone printed it and they call it samatha. Samatha. This is the correct pronunciation. It's going to say shamatha.
Shamatha.
In Tibetan, shine. I'm going to give you the definition of shamatha. Because shamatha is like Shamatha is like the ultimate evolution of the fifth perfection. Okay? And I'll give you the definition. People are always talking shamatha, 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 and they don't know any idea what it is. This is the definition from scripture. Meditative concentration which is infused with the extraordinary pleasure of agility, and I'll talk about that, brought on by being in deep one-pointed meditation upon the particular object of focus. Upon the particular object of focus. That's the definition of shamatha. So what are the elements there? It's a kind of meditative concentration. Okay, first of all, it's fixed one-pointedly on its object. Secondly, and it leads to what we call agility. It causes what we call agility. And that agility brings you some kind of deep pleasure. And those are all the elements of shamatha. That's what distinguishes shamatha from other kinds of meditation. What does it imply? You're so good at keeping your mind on one object that you reach agility. It's called agility of mind and body. The body part means that you could sit for very, very long periods of time and your body is totally used to it. Agility here means your body, and Jetsun Khapa says it very strongly in his Lam Rim, in this Lam Rim. He says, your body is like totally under your control. If you want to keep it there sitting without moving for 2-3 hours, no problem. It's totally, you have mastered your body. And your body, you've been in meditation so much that you can make your body do whatever you want. Okay? You're so used to meditating that it's called agility of body. You can tell your body, okay, now listen, body, we're going to sit here for 3 hours and you're not going to move. And you're so good at it and you're so used to it that it just does it. And then you have this mental agility. Mental agility in this case means you decide to fix your mind on an object and you can keep it there at will. You know, at will. It means, I don't know, like some kind of total mastery over your mind and body. You say to Mr. Body, we're going to sit here for 3 hours, you're not going to move. Mr. Mind, you're going to focus on this thing and you are not going to think of another thing, and they do it. And as a result of that, you get some very, very pleasant sensations. It brings on a bliss of body and mind. That bliss is not a goal, and in fact, in the Bodhisattva vows, it says, "Samde rova chapapo." Do not get attached to this elation of body and mind. It is not a Buddhist goal, but it's cool, and it's, you know, you can enjoy it. You can enjoy it. Don't get attached to it. Don't mistake it for any kind of spiritual goal. It's not. But it's a very nice side effect. Okay. And that's shamatha. Okay. Now I'll go on to the ultimate form of wisdom, and then I'm going to stop. Which is called what? That's the object of it. Pali is a corruption of Sanskrit, and in Pali it comes out vipassana. This is the Sanskrit form. This is the original form of the word, vipassana. Okay? In Tibetan it's phlaktol. Phlak means special or extraordinary. Tong means to see. I like to call it the vision of emptiness or something like that. Some people call it insight. I'm not quite sure about that translation because insight to me implies some kind of thinking. Like I have insight into that problem or something. So it's not restricted to that. It can be a kind of analytical thinking, but it also refers to the direct perception of emptiness. Okay. So I feel a little uncomfortable about insight. Vision to me like means could be either one, a deep understanding of something like that. I'll give you the definition. Okay. This is one of my pet peeves in Buddhism, along with noble truth and stuff like that. There are schools in America that do vipassana retreats, and they, I believe that they understand vipassana to mean the meditation part, which it's not at all. That's the shamatha part. Vipassana is the other half, which is the, well, you'll understand it from the definition from scripture, okay? A state of wisdom which is infused with the extraordinary pleasure of agility brought on by analyzing its particular object of focus, comma, all based upon a platform of quietude. Quietude meaning shamatha. Okay. What are the elements here? I mean, I'll go through the elements. First of all, you've already established a platform of shamatha. In other words, you are able to put your mind up to a certain level of concentration and stay there. That's the first element here. Then you are taking a particular object and you are analyzing it. Is this self-existent or not? You know, did this come from karma or not? You know, is this a projection or not? You know, it's analyzing that its object of focus. And that analysis brings on a kind of, again, agility of mind and body, meaning that you are able to tell your mind and body what to do perfectly. You know, okay, Mr. Mind, you focus on this thing and you think about its nature for 20 minutes. Mr. Body, in the meantime, you stay still, okay? And you have the absolute ability to tell them what to do. That's agility. It's called Xinjiang. You're able to tell your body and mind what to do and they will listen to you. And that brings on, again, a state of bliss. You know, a state of mental and physical well-being, which is a byproduct and not to be something to be attached. But the point here is that your mind is analyzing the real nature of a thing, and it does not have to be a, what do you call it? Discursive analyzing. It can be the analyzing of perceiving emptiness directly in this case. Okay, there is vipassana going on during the first part of the path of seeing, for example. Okay, and you must have these two together, and it has to come in the following order. And now I'll refer to the direct perception of emptiness, the first time that you see emptiness directly. Path number 5, right here. So I'm talking about here, okay? And this is the whole point of these two perfections. These two perfections, meditation number 5 and wisdom number 6, these two, shamatha and vipassana, are their ultimate evolution. These are the ultimate forms of those two perfections. With regard to the direct perception of emptiness, and I've said it many times before, but I'll just tie it again, you must be able to reach up to a platform of perfect concentration called shamatha. You must be able to get there. Your mind is not in the desire realm anymore. It's actually at a different level. Your mind is at a totally different level. Your sense consciousnesses are totally shut down. You cannot be aware of seeing anything, hearing anything, tasting anything, feeling anything. So your mind must be able to get to that point. And I repeat that you cannot get to that level if you don't practice an hour or two a day without fail. You cannot. You will not be able to get there. People say, well, what am I going to do? I only have 45 minutes before work. Go find yourself another job. Okay? What's more important? You know, what's more important as you're dying? You know, that you've got that extra half hour of pay? Or what? Go find a job where you can spend an hour or two a day. You must. And where you're not exhausted the next morning, that you can't do it. You must. There's no choice. There's really no choice. As a Buddhist, you're required to have a good livelihood, an honest livelihood, and not to grub off other people. You're required. Not to impinge on other people. But you must find a livelihood where you can meditate an hour or two a day. You must find a livelihood like that. You have to decide. If you don't, you won't be able to see emptiness. Okay? Just won't be able to do it. And if your job exhausts you, that you can't really meditate properly, then find another job. Find another occupation. You know, there's no question of what's more important. So you have to be able to reach that platform and stay on it at will. And that's shamatha. And then based on that platform, you start to gain the ability to see the emptiness of an object. And very typically, it comes from a lot of classroom hours. That's a requirement. A lot of classroom hours. And specifically, you have to study the subjects of Madhyamika. and the perfection of wisdom. You must study those. You must spend many hours learning them. And then it has some effect on your brain. If you just do it once or twice, nothing will happen. So you must have these two combined, and that's the whole point of the last part of Jetsun Khapa's Lamrim. And that's all I have to say about his Lamrim. Okay? At the end he says, you must find the union of these two. You must come to the union of these two. You must gain that platform, and then you must, based on that platform, you must perceive emptiness. Okay? You must. Very important. Last thing, he gets into a little bit of the secret teachings. And what he says is, once you've studied the paths which are common to the secret and open teachings, which refers to what paths are used in both the secret teachings and the open teachings. What particular teaching is used in both the study of the secret Buddhism? Lamrim. What you just learned is indispensable in both the open teachings and the secret teachings. When you get to the secret teachings, they will not work unless you are a master of Lamrim. Okay. You can take all the initiations you want. You can keep all the weird ritual objects you want. You can have all the weird rituals you want. You know, you can have all the holy substances you want. You can wear any kind of weird costume you want, and nothing will happen. Guaranteed. You must have Lamrim. You must have everything we just talked about. And then it says Dorje Lupin Latse, find a diamond master and then enter the secret path. Okay. And then you will achieve the goals in this life. But you must have Lamrim. Right. Did you have a question?
Yeah, the ability to just command your mind and your body.
I like that word. That's cool. Yeah.
I remember speaking to somebody who was a Hatha yoga practitioner, mm-hmm. and they did some study in Hinduism, and they had said that originally Hatha yoga practice, the word yoga means union, and used the word union before. Mm-hmm. And originally the Hatha yoga practices were a way to tame the body so that people could sit quietly in meditation. There was a need
to those practices, particularly to sit for meditation purposes, and meditation, and not be able to control flight. So that was an offshoot of that. I'm just wondering if you want to comment on that. No, I don't know. In meditation, it's very common to get. We talked about it last Saturday. If there's a disruption of the breath. That affects, if the mind is disturbed, it affects the inner winds, which subject is secret, and I can't describe it much. But if the inner winds are affected, the breathing is then affected. So it's like, if mind affects winds, winds affect breath. And then so when you're excited, your breath is faster. When you're agitated or stressed, your breath is not smooth. It's jerky. And that's just a sign that your mind is agitated. The opposite also happens. If you are trying to meditate hard, and you're working on your breath, for example, it can affect your mind. It screws up the inner winds, and then the inner winds affect the mind. And you start to get what we call lung. Lung means inner wind, but in meditation it means a problem of the inner wind. And you start to get people go crazy or get nervous or... you know, can't sleep and they have to stop their retreat or something. Very, very common. And in order to prevent that, there's a certain diet you could follow and some kinds of exercise. So there is a place for that, particularly when you are trying to develop shamatha. Like you can go on a special retreat to try to develop shamatha. And in that case, it's important to, if you start to have that problem,